LA has the largest jail system in the country.
You got people that been in jail just like one time in their life, can't get nothing because of whatever mistake they made.
I stole some ground turkey because I wanted to feed my family. We was hungry.
Off the Block, stories tracing the path from city block to cell block and back. Find it now at kcrw.com or subscribe on iTunes.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Tinsberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and welcome to Bookworm. Today, I feel like the show is having a grandchild. My guest is Nadja Spiegelman. Both of her parents, Art Spiegelman and Françoise Mouly, have been guests on Bookworm. And this book, I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This, is a memoir, and as you all know, generally I don't talk about memoirs on Bookworm, but I thought that this book was something beyond the facts of memory and had entered into, for lack of a less pretentious term, the metaphysics of truth. Is that okay, Nadja?
I love that, yes.
Okay. And I discovered that there was, in addition, an epigraph from one of my favorite writers, poets, thinkers. I have a complete set of his work. It's Paul Valéry. Will you read this quote in French?
La mémoire ne nous servirait à rien si elle fût rigoureusement fidèle.
And now that we've intimidated you all into thinking that this metaphysical French-thinking book will be unreadable, what is the translation?
It means memory would be useless if it were rigorously faithful.
Okay. Memory would be useless if it were rigorously faithful. What does that mean to you?
I think that we have these distinctions between fiction and nonfiction that have always baffled me, because so much of our lives are a self-construction that we move through. We're constantly rewriting our own pasts to lead up to the present. We're constantly telling stories to answer the questions that we have, from Greek myths to monotheistic religion to the Big Bang Theory. The questions of why am I alive, we answer with stories. And the question of why am I who I am, we answer with stories. Stories that are shaped by the narrative omissions of our memory.
Well, I'm fascinated by the book because, you see, I knew you when you were truly a little girl. And the book is an act of self-definition. It's sort of an act of growing up, yes?
I grew up through writing this book, and I'm sure there were other paths I could have taken and would have found other ways to do it. But from this vantage point, it feels like I couldn't have grown up without writing this book.
I'm going to ask Nadja to read from the opening two pages, because it very quickly establishes the figure of her mother as a magical figure and as one who has extraordinary powers over reality. This is Nadja Spiegelman reading from the first chapter of I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This.
Chapter 1. When I was a child, I knew that my mother was a fairy. Not the kind of fairy with gauzy wings and a magic wand, but one with a thrift store fur coat and ink-stained fingers. There was nothing she couldn't do. On weekends, she put on safety goggles, grabbed a jigsaw, and remade the cabinets in her bedroom. She ran a hose from her bathroom to the roof to fill my inflatable pool. She helped me build a diorama of the rainforest, carving perfect cardboard birds of paradise with her X-Acto blade. Maman, I asked her when I was 4, when will I be a fairy like you? When you're 16, she replied. And so I waited, and I watched her. Once, during a thunderstorm in Brazil, my mother pulled the rental car over to the side of the highway by a dark, deserted beach. She beckoned to my brother and me. We uncurled from the back seat and leapt out into the electric rain. We followed her, leaving my father shouting her name from the road, his voice barely carrying over the storm. We stripped down to our underwear. My mother held out her hands, one for each of us, and we ran straight into the water. The ocean picked us up and slammed us down again against the sand. We screamed with laughter. We ran back in. The sky fractured with lightning, opened, fell into the ocean. The waves reared twice as tall as my mother. At the car, my father was pale, his voice quiet with awe and anger. "Jesus, Françoise," he said, shaking his head. We were late now, as usual, and my mother drove the car fast down the highway toward the pitch-black sky. Though we had been in 2 accidents, I did not know my mother was a reckless driver until I was in my 20s and friends told me so. The things my mother did not see about herself, I did not see, either. We fell asleep in the back seat, my brother and I, mouths open, gritty with salt and sand, our hair drying in wild curls. My mother disdained most dangers as American constructs, invented by timid women who washed their vegetables. She was always certain that nothing would go wrong. "No one ever told me it was dangerous to swim in a lightning storm," she would say, when I laughingly mentioned the memory years later. Her voice pitched defensively. She did not like to be teased. There were other vacations, too. The vacation when my mother, sick of the other moms who complained about the lack of apple juice at the breakfast buffet, absconded from the resort and let me drive the rented stick-shift Jeep along the dirt roads, even though my feet barely reached the pedals. The vacation when my mother booked no hotels in advance, just took off driving down the coast of Costa Rica, buying us all the strange fruits that they sold by the roadside. My father rarely came with us. Once in a forest, my mother scooped the earth into her hand and put some in her mouth and ours while she explained about building immunities. We were often sick as children, and then rarely. We knew, my brother and I, that it was only fear that led to danger. My mother cast around us her conviction that we would always be safe, and it held us like a force field.
That's Nadja Spiegelman reading from her memoir, I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This. Now, the Françoise we hear about in these paragraphs, and by the way, fear is for women who wash their vegetables, is hilarious, seems to be a force of nature, and certainly it's a very interesting dichotomy in this book, because not only is that how a child sees her mother, but your mother is a force of nature. There's some truth in it. And what we learn in this book is that your mother also had a stupendously willful mother who could deform or reform reality, and that among what we now, by the end of the book, see as 4 generations of Muli women, the act of warring over who is going to be able to control reality. So the young Nadja Spiegelman, who is the daughter of Art Spiegelman, the Pulitzer Prize-winning writer of Mouse, and Françoise Muli, who is the art editor of The New Yorker, had, once she went to college at Yale, to take control of her life, and she did it in a writing class run by another daughter named Anne Fetterman. She was the daughter of Clifton Fetterman.
That's right.
Yeah. Who was the person who chose the serious books for the Book of the Month Club. He had a big influence on American writing. Did she teach you to conquer the fear of the parent?
The fact that we were both daughters of formidable artists, I think, was a thing we had quietly in common, but rarely mentioned until after I was no longer in her class. But I got the inspiration for this book in part in her class because she taught a class called Writing About Oneself. And as one of the pioneering journalists in the form of creative nonfiction, she was very clear on a journalist's responsibility to the truth, even when it came to writing about your own life. And so in one course, she told us, if you're writing about a memory of your mother, don't add in any details that you're not absolutely certain are true. Don't say your mother was wearing a blue dress simply because there's a photo of your mother wearing a blue dress that you can remember. Only say what you know to be true. And that sent me into a tailspin because my own memory is so malleable that the photo of my mother wearing a blue dress could easily superimpose itself onto the memory to the point where I believed that she was wearing that dress that day. And if I started going further into it, my mother might not have said what I thought she said, or maybe I'd completely misinterpreted it, or maybe that memory that I had actually had happened 5 years before I thought it had, and I couldn't make head or tail of how we were supposed to be truthful to our memories when our memories were so ever-shifting, and that was something that became really interesting to me.
So the book is about the very interesting and I think important and universal subject of how does a young person get over the tendency to believe that the adults around him or her are inevitably right and that other memories are better than one's own. And the terrific question in both senses, terrifying and major, of what is truth?
For me, at some point in the book, I say that that magic to me was meaning superimposed on chaos. And for me, truth was narrative power. Truth was a kind of magic that allowed one the shape that one needed to move forward and backward through one's life with agency in the way that one wanted to. And that sounds like such a shaky definition of truth that is so subjective. My mother was such a formidable figure, and I had so much admiration for her. And it is even now very difficult for me to ever believe something that my mother doesn't agree with, and it's very disturbing to me when we have these arguments. But it's also incredibly important in terms of figuring out who I am. One of the incidents I write about in the book is a moment when my mother's reality just completely overtook my own, and she believed that I was stealing food from the kitchen, that I was not stealing. But her insistence about it was strong enough that I eventually came to believe that I was. And that feeling of losing hold on my own reality was profoundly terrifying to me. And I think that that was the moment when I realized that I needed to write things down. I needed to have a reality that was my own. I needed something fixed in the past that I could point to and trust that came from my own narrative force and not from hers.
Well, throughout the book, that issue of eating and weight and proper eating is addressed. And when the also formidable grandmother is met, one of the first things she says to Nadja is, "Oh, my dear, you're beautiful, but you're melting away."
Yes.
And I think, you know, we've all been told it, but beautiful is in the mind's eye. And beautiful is in our mind's eye as well. And now I think it would be very rare that someone would meet Nadja Spiegelman and would not say, "Oh, you're beautiful." Well, how was that accomplished?
I think that the body is such an intense battleground between so many mothers and daughters and so many parents and children, because for so long it's something that the parent controls, and it became such a fraught territory between my mother and I. In terms of how I gained confidence, I just decided that it didn't matter what I thought that I looked like. I put a sock under my mirror so that it was angled slightly so that I looked longer and thinner whenever I looked in it, and decided that it was fine for me to willfully engage in this illusion, because as long as I was projecting a certain kind of confidence to the world, that's what I hoped would be received.
And interestingly, your mother had lessons for you there as well, to receive the glances from men that you began to get as rewards, instead of feeling worried or hurt or invaded. She said, there's nothing you can do. This was once, obviously, she had agreed that you were beautiful too.
Yeah, I think there's a certain kind of protecting that my mother felt she needed to do specifically for her daughter that was different than what she felt she needed to do for her son, and that it relates to something that my grandmother tells me when she's telling me about her life as a child, which is she's asked to bring a proverb into school, and so she makes one up, and her proverb is, you must always want what you can't avoid. And she's talking about war, but it's similar to what my mother tells me when she's talking about the glances from men in the street, that as a woman, there are certain things that will make you feel less than powerful, and that the only way to deal with them is to decide that you are in control and that you wanted them and that you can turn them into something that is useful. It's interesting because it's such a complete generational gap in some sense, because in my university, I grew up as this young feminist in New York, and for me, it has always been important to hold the world accountable for the ways in which it strips you of power. And my mother and my grandmother, both in their different circumstances, so refuse to ever see themselves as victims. And it's so different from how we talk about things today, where we give a lot of emphasis to people who have historically been victimized and give a lot of power to the status of being a victim. But my mother and my grandmother, who lived through many difficult things, would constantly phrase it in a sense of, I made mistakes. It led me to this situation. I learned from it. I don't blame anybody but myself. And that is actually it was really useful for me to hear that from them.
Well, there is a moment in the book. You went to Stuyvesant High School, very fine high school in New York, but it was very close to the site of the World Trade Center. And on 9/11, you were there in high school, and you say, there are many people who are asked, would your mother run into a burning building to save you? I don't have to ask that question. I was in a burning building, and both of my parents came to get me, to rescue me. So, in a sense, the love in this book has always been there. It's incontestable. So what is it? Can you define the thing that you're trying to win? It's not exactly her love, and it's not exactly her respect. What would you say it is?
I think for a while, I was trying to have her accept my reality, to have her accept my memories of the way things were. Part of my mother's force is about making the impossible become possible in the future, but it radiates out backwards as well and involves changing the past into what she wishes it were rather than what it was, in a way that I think we all do, but that I think she does. And I felt this burning need for her to acknowledge that there had been these difficult moments between us, that we'd had these fights, for her, not even necessarily for an apology, but simply just that we could agree upon a shared past. And writing this book gave me the freedom actually to get the space from it and say, I have a reality, she has a reality, they don't need to line up, in a way that actually allowed me to listen to and engage with her version of our shared past that I never had been able to before.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. I'm talking with Nadja Spiegelman about her book, I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This, a memoir. We'll continue after this short.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.
Listen to the Rhythm Planet podcast to explore music from all corners of the globe. Brazilian, European, African, and tropical Latin. Rhythm Planet is a state of mind. Listen at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet or on KCRW's app.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Nadja Spiegelman about her memoir, I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This, published by Riverhead Books. It's one woman's distillation of time, motherhood, and memory, and what it means for her, the daughter. And you notice that in the generations, daughters and grandmothers get along very well.
Mm-hmm.
Daughters and mothers, not so well. So in these 4 to 5 generations that we witness, it's fascinating to see the same thing happening again and again and again. Now, there is an aspect of both your mother and your grandmother, Jose, who are essentially saying, get over it.
Mm-hmm.
You have to. You have to anyway. There's no choice in the matter. And I think the message in your book is, I will get over it after I write the book.
Yeah, and that's exactly how it felt. My mother and grandmother both said versions to me, my grandmother especially, said versions to me of like, but every daughter when she's an adolescent feels this way about her mother, but that's absolutely normal. Like, in talking about someone else, she said, oh yeah, she tried to kill herself, but you know, the way you do at 16 with like a few pills and the phone nearby. And so I think that's true. I think that adolescence is an incredibly traumatic, violent, and intense time for everybody. I don't think the fact that it's so universal lessens the emotions that we feel at that age. I just think it means that it can be very relatable. And it's something that you then make peace with. For me, that peace was in part writing this book, and then it was in part just making peace with myself and who I was, and realizing that who I was thanks to my mother, that in so many ways she had created me, and even the things that I might continue to resent her for had actually made me into the strong person that I feel I am.
There are people in this book who, your acknowledgments point out, asked not to be a part or not very much of a part of the book. And there's your father, who just as things go is not a major figure here. But something very unusual happens. You ask your mother to talk to you, and she gives it careful thought, and she agrees to be interviewed by you. And she says, toward the end of the book, after she's read the first sections, she doesn't necessarily recognize the person you describe. She knows that it's her in her childhood, but once she's seeing herself through your eyes, she doesn't see it that way.
I think that in agreeing to do this project with me, and especially in finding ways to deal with the existence of this book, it's a proof of an intense love on my mother's part, akin to running into a burning building, if not more intensely so, because that she did instinctively, and this she's done over great time and what I think might be cost to herself. It's difficult to talk about our relationship now, honestly, because it's important to both of us to continue to have privacy in that area. But in terms of how I feel about having done this, when I began the book, I didn't have a concept of what a violent act it was to become the narrator of somebody else's life. And interestingly, it's not the parts where I narrate my mother's childhood or my grandmother's childhood that are troublesome. It's the parts where I talk in the present about how I see them, or talk as an adolescent about how I saw my mother then.
Your mother says at a dinner, "When I think of it, my children are in all my memories, even memories I have of before they were born." Later, she reads that and she says, "I don't remember saying that, but you know I do think that." Now that's a very fascinating, "I don't remember saying it." It's not true, but I do think it. It's more than true. By the end of the book, how did you situate that kind of truth? Because that's the strength of the book, finding what almost can't be said, but is in fact thought.
I made my mother and my grandmother, when I was writing the parts about their past, I made them tell me the same stories over and over and over again, not to get the parts that they might have left out on first telling, but to find the mythology of the story, to find the parts that were the same each time, because that, to me, was what was interesting, is how we create these myths of ourselves. Also in terms of how they changed and new memories came back, but mostly in terms of just how these are the things that we hold on to because they are the building blocks of who we become and they explain who we are. And I think really the hardest parts are the parts about my adolescence, are the parts where it's a past that happened a long time ago that I have turned into my own kind of myth and that she no longer sees that way, or I'm sure never did see that way. I just had to write my version of the truth and then leave there be room for her version of the truth in other places.
I've been talking with Nacha Spiegelman. She's the author of I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This. I have the feeling that that title is as much addressed to the reader as the mother talking to Nacha. Thank you, Nacha, for joining me.
Thank you so much, Michael.
I'm Supposed to Protect You from All This is published by Riverhead Books. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from the book at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Nicholson Baker is our guest.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.